Now, the nation continues to grapple with last week's school shooting in Parkland, Florida, in which the perpetrator took the lives of 17 people. There's been a lot of debate over how to prevent the next tragedy from happening and how to stop guns from ending up in the hands of those who shouldn't have them. Our next guest is calling on Wisconsin lawmakers to create a gun violence restraining order. That's a legal tool that would allow close relatives or maybe other closely connected people to petition a court to temporarily take an individual's gun rights away if they present a danger to themselves or others. Nino Amato is public policy chair for the group United Against Hate. He's also the president and CEO of the Coalition for Wisconsin Aging Groups and an adjunct professor at the UW teaching criminal justice, social change, and sustainable public policy. Nino, welcome back to the show.
Thank you.
Well, give us the basics. How would this gun violence restraining order work?
Yeah, in simple terms, it's no different than someone getting a restraining order from someone who's being tracked or abused or... You've got people online, you know, doing some crazy things. In essence, what it does is it provides not just law enforcement, but teachers, family members, fellow students, a counselor, just about anybody, even a neighbor for that matter. Because if you look at the last five shootings, the FBI did have some of these people in their database. But it's a long process. What this does is makes a speed track to local government, to a judge, where you can't just arbitrarily say that person has a problem. You have to present evidence, much like you do in the case of a whistleblower. Then that person has a right to contest it, but you immediately bring them to court. At that point, if you have enough evidence, and there was enough evidence based upon what was already filed, there could have been a restraining order to do two things. One, you could never buy a gun, plus they could go into the home and take those guns away. And that would have prevented this case and four other cases as well.
And one of the key points here is this is a temporary thing, right? Someone who's been subject to this could get that reversed over time?
Yeah, absolutely. There's five components, and I'm glad you mentioned that. It has to be time specific, so it can't be any more than a year. And at the end of the year, if the people who filed the complaint still feel that it's valid to proceed, then that person can contest it as well. So it would pass muster relative to due process and would pass muster relative to constitutionality. Now, I believe in a lot of other common sense gun regulation that should be there. But at this point in time, what we really need to do is look for bipartisanship. And you would think this should be bipartisan. What Obama is currently proposing is an absolute sham. And let's not forget...
Obama,
I'm sorry. What Trump is proposing is an absolute sham. What Trump did and promised in the election is he was going to reverse Obama's last executive order that mandated Social Security Administration to turn over all records who were receiving Social Security with mental illness to the background check database. That would have impacted about 75,000 per year. What that would have done is then that would have been immediately into the database. He promised the NRA that he would, in fact, reverse that decision and kill it. And that's exactly what he did. What he's proposing now is fine-tuning a law that's already in place that if you get a dishonorable discharge and you've had any type of domestic violence while you're in the military, that record did not get into the background check. So there's doing very little, if anything. This is much broader. But let me just say this. This isn't about common sense gun control legislation and what's right or wrong. This is about money. Over $22 million went to 10 U.S. senators, all Republicans. And when it gets down to this, this is about a political action group called the NRA that's no longer training people. It's all about money and candidates. And it's also all about the fact, too, that they want other legislation. They want silencers legalized. When we had the chance after Las Vegas to prohibit bump stocks, they killed a bill. They killed any discussion. So to me, it's a red herring on the part of the administration. And I can simply say this. I'm really pleased to see high school students taking to the streets. They're making very good sense. I saw it in 1968 when I was a high school student when we protest the war in Vietnam. So there is a movement here, and it's got to put the fear of God into a lot of politicians right now.
So some of what you just talked about, there's going to be a lot of partisan disagreement over. This gun violence restraining order, you see Maybe bipartisan. And David French in the National Review wrote an opinion piece making a very similar case to what you're talking about in a conservative publication.
Absolutely. There should be no reason. When they say thoughts and prayer and we need to get mental people out from buying guns, here's a classic case that's already been tested under law to use. And if we can come together, that's great. But the NRA, quietly behind the scenes, is opposed to it. They're opposed to anything. And it all started back after Reagan had put a prohibition on selling assault rifles. When the sunset provision came up in 1992 after Clinton was elected, the NRA started to take a very hard line as an advocacy group. And they basically said, take no prisoners, and we're not going to have any indications of gun control. So as much as they're silent, they're working to kill even a potential nonpartisan bill like this because they scare the incumbents from either putting a challenger against them or backing money against their opponent.
This gun violence restraining order exists in a handful of other states, correct?
California has used it very well. Other states are following. Given the last shootings in the last year, more and more are looking ways to do it. And for instance, you might recall a number of years ago in Brookfield where a deranged husband who went through a divorce walked into a beauty parlor where his ex-wife was working and shot her and killed her friend. What you had there was a situation where she had already filed a domestic complaint. That would have shown up and therefore also would have prevented someone with domestic abuse. The other thing we have to remember here is that it's not about guns kill people. That argument where they say people kill people is ridiculous. It's ridiculous because we have a military and we have service people. And what do they give them to kill the enemy? To kill guns. This should really go into effect so it allows a broader base of people besides just family members, teachers, and others to go in and make a formal complaint, have to go under the rigor of evidence, and then have the person come with due process. That could have stopped this.
We're talking to Nino Amato from the group United Against Hate. He says Wisconsin lawmakers should adopt a gun violence restraining order law. It's a legal tool that would allow certain citizens to petition a court to temporarily take an individual's gun rights away if that person's a significant danger to him or herself or others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you support a gun violence restraining order in Wisconsin? Should individual citizens be given more power when it comes to this method of possibly preventing shootings, of preventing gun violence? Is this law the right way to go about it? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@wpr.org. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Nino Amato is with us from the group United Against Hate. He says Wisconsin should adopt a gun violence restraining order law that would allow some people to challenge an individual's gun rights in effect if they demonstrate that they pose a significant danger to themselves or others. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Would you support this idea of a gun violence restraining order temporarily separating someone from their firearms? Or do you think it's a bad idea? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. We'll go to our callers now. Denise is with us in Madison. Denise, hi.
Hey, can you hear me?
Are you there, Denise?
Yeah, I'm there.
Okay, what do you think?
Yeah, so I'm absolutely in favor of this idea. A number of years ago, I would say about seven years ago now, my husband was being stalked. He was academic, and he had a disgruntled student that decided that it was his fault that he couldn't finish his degree, and he decided to start stalking. There's an official definition. It doesn't just mean somebody's looking you up online, and it means like the person was actually sending him threatening emails and phone calls, suggesting in some kind of vague ways that he intended to do something really serious. We were actually, his husband's work was locked down. They had all kinds of police involved. They had all kinds of restraining orders set up against my husband and a couple other staff people. And you know what? Nothing prevented this guy from getting a gun. Like he was able to purchase anything. I mean, there was no list with his name on it. It's it's just shocking that, like, even though we could have restraining orders because we were so worried and we were locking down all the buildings, that we, you know, we had our arms tied behind our back when it came to certain kinds of prevention.
Denise, thanks for the call, and that's what you're hoping to address in part.
Denise hits the nail on the head, because this is about verbal or written violent behavior by individuals. So in this case, they could file a complaint, get a restraining order, and that person would not be able to go in and buy a gun. And if they have guns, they'd have to turn those over until the restraining order ends and their behavior should end. And let me just emphasize, this law is consistent with and is recognized with the inherent self-defense and the inherent due process under law. And it specifically targets, again, not someone who's committed domestic violence, that should be included automatically, but it basically deals with the kind of verbal abuse we just heard from Denise. The other thing I want to make it aware of people in Wisconsin, we had tough gun laws here in the state. We had a 48-hour waiting period. The police, the sheriff's department, local law enforcement all wanted to maintain it. And this governor, unfortunately, and this legislature got eliminated the 48-hour. In Florida, they have a 72-hour waiting period. And now there's legislation being proposed that if you can't buy a beer at age 18, you shouldn't be able to buy a gun at 18. And now they're looking at pushing it to 21. Those are simple things we should be doing.
Denise, thanks for the call. Go next to Chris on the line in Slinger. Chris, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I find this whole topic to be absurd and a bunch of malarkey. It's just another overreaction of something that happened. If the FBI would have taken care of business down in Florida, this wouldn't have happened. But I'm going to run a scenario past your guest, and I'd like to hear his comment. I live in a home. I have guns. My neighbor is a knucklehead, starts acting weird. He knows that I have guns in my house. He calls the police on me because he knows that I have guns in my house, and then I'm going to be harassed by the police and have a restraining order put against me.
Chris, I got you. We're just about out of time. Nino, could this be abused?
Well, it could be abused if local officials do not follow the proper steps. And the proper steps is that if his neighbor would basically file a complaint, he has a right now to go through and basically show me evidence. What have I done that has threatened you in any way or anything else? So there is a due process clause here, and that has worked in the past for other restraining orders, and it holds up under court. Let me just add one other thing, too. This is not a bunch of malarkey. 200 people have died in the last couple of years. More people have died from domestic terrorists of young males getting access to guns and going into schools or going into churches, killing people. That's more than ISIS has done in this state. In this country. So here's a chance to come together and do something. His concerns are valid, but all the more reason why we have it in place. We don't have to create new laws. We just have to follow the process.
Nino, thanks for joining us.
Thank
Chris,
you.
Thanks for that call. That was Nino Amato, public policy chair for the group United Against Hate. He joined us to talk about the idea of gun violence restraining orders. He would like to see them become a reality here in Wisconsin. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. When we know someone is pregnant, we often help out in one way or another, open some doors for them, lift the heavy stuff, attend or plan the baby shower, ask how they're doing. But after the baby is born, a lot of the attention goes to the baby. Frequently, just a week after the birth, a new parent is on their own with their kid in charge of their own needs and the unfamiliar needs of the new baby. Our next guest says we should learn from other cultures about taking better care of the new mom. Dr. Kathleen Kendall-Tackett is a health psychologist and lactation consultant. Kathy, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much.
Well, I want to start with the outcome here, a problem you're hoping to solve. We have, it sounds like, a lot more of the baby blues or full-on postpartum depression in the United States than a lot of other places around the world.
No, it's absolutely true, and it's really unfortunate. I think it's really tough for many of our mothers here in this country.
And why is that? How did we end up paying so much attention to the woman while she's pregnant and so little afterward?
Well, it was kind of a strange thing that happened. You know, it's like if you look at, like, historical accounts, you know, like, say, in colonial America, you know, the women had, you know, tended to have their babies at home, and they really had to help each other out because if they didn't, you know, they wouldn't survive. You know, and then what happened is we started gradually, like, especially in the 1920s and 30s, moving a lot of deliveries into the hospital, and then women would stay there for an extended length of time, you know, 10 days, 2 weeks, kind of get their feet under them before they went back home. Now, there's a lot of reasons why, you know, extended hospital stays are not necessarily a good idea. You know, separation of mom and baby and things like that, exposure to germs. But what happened is when we started shortening the hospital stays, there, we didn't get any of that compensation in, you know, back in terms of the mom, you know, getting somebody to take care of her after she has her baby. So what happens is moms are expected to basically come home from the hospital and step right back into their life. And so there's no sort of even acknowledgement of what she's even gone through in this huge transformation of having a baby.
Talk about that transformation a little more. I think, you know, as someone who myself obviously has never had a child and never will, talk about the physical and emotional demands, plus just the day-to-day logistics of all of a sudden being a new parent at home.
Well, I think, first of all, you know, it's a profound, if I could say, even spiritual shift. You know, it's like this new human being has come into your house, you know, and there's just a, you know, that's such a huge accomplishment. And, you know, and oftentimes it's sort of preceded by maybe a labor that was difficult or scary, and women don't even really have anybody to talk to about that. And then suddenly they're trying to, you know, cope with breastfeeding, and they've got all this competing information, and then they've got, you know, movie stars posting about how they got their body back in 2 weeks, you know, and that's just not reality for most women. And then oftentimes, especially in this country, our mothers go back to work so soon. So just when they just start to kind of get a little bit of a rhythm, suddenly, boom, they've got to go into a whole new thing. And so, you know, oftentimes they're very conflicted because there isn't, you know, a lot of times good alternatives for who's going to take care of that baby and how they're going to manage everything. And so it's very, very, it's very challenging, you know, and it's like they're a lot of times expected to come home and, you know, immediately start taking care of everybody else again, rather than have, you know, people look and fuss after them, which is the way they do it in a lot of other parts of the world.
Yeah, you recently wrote about how other cultures do this, do things that provide some of the emotional support, some practical support, and even some of those spiritual needs. Can you talk about a few of the customs that might be inspirations for us here?
Well, you know, one of the articles that I based that, the article that you read on, was an anthropological study where they looked at a lot of these different cultures around the world, and they were very different from each other. They looked, you know, at, you know, Punjabi women. They looked at Latina women in, you know, Los Angeles. They looked at, you know, people in China. You know, they looked at people in very, very different cultures, and what they tried to do is sort of tease out what were the things that those cultures were doing that prevented the mothers from having as much depression and having, you know, even the baby blues. I mean, we all assume that the baby blues are just inevitable. They just happen. But what they found is that in a lot of these countries, even the baby blues were almost non-existent versus they hit about 85% of mothers in the United States, you know, and other industrialized countries as well. And so they started noticing, you know, a couple of things. Like one thing, there was an acknowledgement of what the new mother had been through. You know, that there was, you know, there was a wonderful story in there I share about, you know, what the Chaga people of Uganda do, you know, and there's a ceremony for mothers when they sort of finally step out with their baby at 3 months postpartum. You know, they're kept secluded for that first, you know, 3 months, and then they actually have this stepping out ceremony, and it acknowledges the mother. You know, in, you know, Punjabi culture, you know, oftentimes the gifts are not for the baby, they're for the mother. You know, so there's this acknowledgement of what she's been through. You know, it's a really big journey, you know, to give birth to a child by however, whatever means. You know, and I know a lot of adoptive parents feel the same thing. It's like, you know, all of a sudden this baby comes, and it's like there's no acknowledgement that things are even different for you because now you have a completely different role. So that was one thing that they did. Another thing was sort of separating the mothers in those first few weeks. You know, acknowledging that this is a vulnerable time, you know, and encouraging her to rest instead of her getting up and making snacks for everybody who wants to come see the baby. It's the other way around. People show up at her house, they bring food, they clean up the house, they throw a load of laundry in. They don't sit there and expect the mother to get up and entertain them. You know, so those are some of the aspects and ways that these cultures actually support new mothers in a way that really encourages both breastfeeding and good maternal mental health. You know, and both those things are just absolutely critical. And so, again, like I said, you know, we have a lot of discussion going on right now in this country about how, you know, talking about women's choice about whether they breastfeed or not. But, you know, the thing I argue is oftentimes we set up many barriers in our culture that make it difficult for women to do that. You know, we have this expectation, but then we make it really, really hard for them to do. You know, and many things are not really the mother's choice at all, but there are these barriers that are set up in our culture, and part of it is just there's just this lack of acknowledgement that there's anything different about the postpartum period.
So is this we need a culture shift? Is that what needs to happen here to think about those first few weeks, first few months after childbirth?
I think so. You know, we have an awful lot of moms, you know, going back to work even at 2 and 3 weeks postpartum. You know, even just comparing ourselves to Canada, you know, just right across the border, they think we're kind of barbaric the way we treat mothers. And I actually have to agree, you know, that we have moms going back to work so early. And even moms who are affluent, you know, even if there's like maternity leave policies in place, mothers feel a pressure a lot of times to sort of, quote, get back to their normal life instead of acknowledging that there is now a new normal. You know, and so, it's, again, I said, I think part of it is, you know, there has to be, you know, a much better structure in terms of maternity leave. But also, you know, just this lack of postpartum support. You know, in other countries, you know, there's home visitors that come in. You know, women are hooked into, like, a network, you know, of other mothers, and they can find the resources they need. We basically sort of toss our moms out, and they have to kind of fend for themselves. And then we wonder why our rates of depression and things like that are going up.
You also point toward what you see as a positive trend, doulas who
yes.
stick around not just pre-childbirth, but after.
Absolutely. Yeah, the postnatal doula is something that I think is a really positive trend. You know, a doula is this word, it's a Greek word, and it comes from the word for bondservant. But it's basically somebody who goes into the home in the postpartum period and just kind of takes care of the mom. You know, it's not about the old traditional baby nurse. They would go in and just sort of basically take the baby away from the mom and take care of the baby themselves. What the doula concept is the doula comes in and basically mothers the mother. You know, make sure that there's groceries, you know, tidies things up, maybe put some fresh sheets on the bed, you know, just takes care of her. You know, maybe provide some child care for other children in the household. It gives the mother a chance to really sort of recuperate and rest and just, you know, sort of feel taken care of. And that just all of that really kind of helps her kind of ease into this role a little bit better.
For people listening who maybe know someone who's approaching childbirth, maybe in the next couple of months, what advice do you have for them to reach out and say, hey, I know you're going through a big thing soon. What can I do afterward to help out?
Well, I actually like what one of our authors, Michelle Peterson, says. So she's got a wonderful book called Seven Sisters for 7 Days. And she said, you know, especially, and she kind of developed this program herself, you know, when she was kind of struggling as a new mom. But basically what they did the second time around is when people asked what could they do to help, you know, or what would they like as a gift, she asked moms to give them the gift of time. You know, and that to volunteer to say bring in a meal rather than a baby present, you know, or I'll come by on Tuesday and run a load of laundry through for you, just to kind of come in and do some practical things for the mom so she doesn't feel like she has to get up and entertain people when they come, because, you know, that unfortunately is the thing that happens. You know, everybody comes to see the baby and mom's up making snacks for everybody. And so, again, having a way to kind of ask for that, that's actually one of the reasons I like Michelle's book, because she actually gives you, you know, even like, you know, a sample plan and kind of how to do it. She gives you some step-by-step guides. But, you know, doing something practical like that for the mother, you know, find out what she wants. And a lot of times, too, sometimes moms will say, oh, no, don't worry about that. But I think if you come back with a sincere, no, I really would like to do this. I would really like to help you with this. I think you're going to find that most moms will take you up on it, because it's just something that's really nice, and it's something that's really lacking. You know, and it's amazing, too. There's a lot of bonding that happens at that time. You know, so then all of a sudden you become often very close friends with the mom that you step in and help at that time. And so, you know, it's just a real nice practical thing. You don't want to go in there and take over. And you definitely don't want to kind of like all of a sudden swoop in and take the baby. What she needs is somebody to kind of take care of the other stuff, you know, so that she can focus on the baby.
You know, we can register for, you know, baby shower gifts. Has anybody come up
right.
with an app or something for registration to say Tuesday night's dinner, laundry, whatever?
Yeah, there's a couple of things. I was recently, bringing some meals over for a new mom, and there is something called the meal train, and I guess it's a way to kind of coordinate, people bringing the meals for lots of different reasons. But something like that would be, I think, really helpful. And again, like I said, if you want kind of some more step-by-step guides, I definitely would encourage you to take a look at Michelle's book, because she does give you that. It's something like, something like the meal train, or, I think actually, an app for this period would actually be fabulous. Using any kind of sort of technology like that, I think would be actually extremely helpful.
Kathy, briefly as we wrap up, I mean, you're calling for a pretty big change here. Do you see people picking this up? Do you see things changing?
I do see things changing, because when I first started writing about this, having a doula was pretty unusual, and oftentimes the people I know who've been doing it for a long time jumped in at a time when there wasn't even a name for it. The name actually came from a book called The Tender Gift by Dana Raphael. She was the first one who kind of used that term, but we've seen the postpartum doula actually grow into a bigger role than it used to be. So I think people are starting to feel a little more comfortable with asking, because I think that's probably one of the biggest barriers is, mothers don't want to, quote, be seen as, not being able to cope. What I usually come back with is, this idea that, other people and other cultures are not trying to do this all by themselves. We have this sort of like view of the mom in the field, and she has her baby and then gets right back to work. And it's like, in the cultures where, women do that, that's considered actually like a bad thing, a harmful practice. It's not the ideal we want to strive for. Many of these cultures where, we think, these cultures, in these developing countries, the moms are expected to get right back to work. And you find oftentimes those cultures are the ones that really are taking the best care of their moms.
We'll leave it there. Kathy, thanks for joining us. That was Dr. Kathleen Kendall-Tackett, health psychologist and lactation consultant. She joined us to talk about what she says is a lack of care and support for new moms in the United States.